Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's reading of the Triangle Business Journal, as we usually do on the biz page just inside the front cover. And we have a couple of short articles here. The first one, under the heading of Get Vaccinated, Good Advice, is Players Retreat Plans Reopening. Perhaps no restaurant oozes Raleigh like the Players Retreat, and the longtime favorite on Oberlin Road now has an opening date, June 23rd. But owner Gus Gussler, who has spent much of the pandemic on the coast with his wife, has decided to allow only vaccinated patrons initially. "We're placing these temporary policies in place to keep our team and guests safe," Gussler says. "My wife Doris, several of our employees, and a number of our regular guests have severe respiratory issues. Keeping them safe and away from any risk is our top priority." The PR will begin registering vaccinated guests June 8th. And under the heading of Bigger Space comes the article, Glenwood South Tailor Gets Funding. A popular tailor has snagged a $7,500 retail upfit grant from the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. Glenwood South Tailors and Men's Shop got the funding to help with its move to the first floor of 745 West Johnson Street. Owner Brian Burnett had previously been located on the second floor, but now has more space, going from 800 square feet to 2,800 square feet and street-level visibility. "The impact of the retail upfit grant has been tremendous for our business, enabling us to satisfy flooring, lighting, paint, trim, demolition, and space configuration needs," Burnett says. And under the heading of Weekends Free, Greensboro firm changes shifts to attract workers. A firm that maintains aircraft in Greensboro is offering a novel idea to attract workers: weekends off. HAECO Americas, that's H-A-E-C-O, HAECO Americas says it's changing shifts to a family-friendly schedule so that most workers will be scheduled for 40 hours from Monday to Friday. "This new scheduling offers our team more flexibility in work scheduling, but more importantly allows most employees to have weekends off to spend time with their families and friends," says HAECO President Bill Collins, according to the Triad Business Journal. And under the heading of Acquisition comes the article, Community Bank Bulks Up with Deal. One of North Carolina's largest community banks is about to get bigger. First Bank, based in Southern Pines, plans to buy Dunn-based Select Bank and Trust Company in a deal valued at $314.3 million. The combined operation will be a $9.6 billion bank, with $8.3 billion and $6 billion in deposits and loans, respectively, and more than 1,300 employees. Select Bank has been growing its own foothold in the Triangle, a foothold that, according to investor presentation, will help First Bank scale in critical markets like Raleigh. First Bank has had high expectations for the Triangle, heightened recently by the firm's decision to open a new regional headquarters on Raleigh's Six Forks Road. "Our goal is to build a private boutique model in this market," Triangle market leader Travis Bailey said in March. And under the heading of Hiring comes the article, Apple Offering Cool Jobs for Students. Apple is coming to the Triangle and already hiring on college campuses. In fact, the company is hiring campus leaders at universities across the Triangle, including NC State University and NC Central University. The ad for the NC State position says Apple is looking for someone passionate about the Apple brand and also very active in various student organizations and eager to plan events to enrich the lives of students, faculty, and staff. Sure beats slinging pizzas for minimum wage, right? And finally, on this week's biz page comes the article, Warehouse Space Goes Fractional. The rise of co-working spaces sparked a Raleigh company to add a new dimension, fractional warehouse space. Local entrepreneur Philip Freeman, the founder of Murphy's Naturals, has had co-working space at Loading Dock Raleigh for years, a spot where budding entrepreneurs can sip coffee, work on laptops, and sign up for conference space. But growing businesses often need storage space. So Loading Dock has added an area of cages packed with materials from a broad array of rising companies who need space to store inventory. Brian Foos, Loading Dock's Director of Business Development, says the smallest spaces run 100 square feet and start at $500 a month. Larger spaces are available. The leases start with a three-month minimum, but businesses can go month to month after that. The concept has been so popular that the Loading Dock is expanding the concept to a warehouse on Beryl Road near Meredith College, and a warehouse that had been vacant in downtown Wake Forest. One company with space at Loading Dock Raleigh is Furbish, an interior design and decorating business. "We've been growing exponentially in the past year and a half," says Furbish's Umar Wahid, while working in a space packed with inventory. Foos said this concept for fractional warehouse space was sparked by what Freeman found he needed in launching Murphy's Naturals and trying to scale that business. "He always thought about the challenges he faced," Foos said. Now we turn the page and reach the banking and tech section of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And we find here a short article under the heading of Key Hire. Texas Bank quietly moves into Triangle. Quietly, Dallas-based Bank Comerica is making a major play in North Carolina. With no fanfare whatsoever, the bank tapped Jerry Bowen, formerly a local Wells Fargo executive vice president, to be president of its southeast market. Comerica confirmed the hire, but didn't offer many details. "We can confirm that we've hired a leader in the market and are in the process of seeking the proper approvals to operate within the market," spokeswoman Wendy Bridges said in an email. She declined to give further details. Comerica's interest in the Triangle was news to Peter Gwaltney, CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association. And also in the banking segment, the article, J.P. Morgan ramps back up across market. Mary Pearson, Triangle Market Director for J.P. Morgan Chase, says the bank's aggressive Triangle rollout is back on track after being temporarily delayed by the pandemic. "We're getting there," she says. "We have 6 branches open today. We have several more on the docket by the end of the year that we're excited to get opened. The Triangle is moving along. We're definitely not on pause anymore." The company currently has 450 employees across the state. And under the heading of 2,100 jobs comes the article, North Carolina misses out on Peloton project. Exercise giant Peloton Interactive considered and rejected North Carolina for its first ever U.S. factory. The manufacturer of the popular smart exercise bikes made the rejection official in May, announcing plans for a $400 million, 2,174-job facility in Troy Township, Ohio. David Rhodes, spokesman for North Carolina Department of Commerce, confirmed that his team had been working to reel in Peloton, but it wasn't immediately clear where exactly Peloton was considering in the Tar Heel State. Rhodes did not say whether North Carolina offered Peloton an incentives package. The company, which did $1.8 billion in revenue in 2020, declined to comment on its site selection search. Peloton has had dealings with North Carolina before, particularly in the Triad. Last year, Peloton announced the acquisition of Precor, a Washington-based company that operated a 230,000-square-foot plant in Whitsitt. The deal is expected to close by the end of 2021. With the deal, Precor becomes a division of Peloton. The factory, officials said, would provide an additional 625,000 square feet of manufacturing capacity statewide. And finally, on the banking and tech page for this week, under the heading of federal case, comes the article Limits for WFH Tested. Technical difficulties and working from home are at the center of a recently filed federal lawsuit in Raleigh, where a woman claims she was wrongfully fired by a global business services company over a faulty headset and an unwillingness to return to the office. The lawsuit filed against California-based firm Concentrix is one of the first examples of the potential legal complications brought about by the work-from-home era in North Carolina. Plaintiff Marie Johnson, like many of her colleagues at Concentrix, began working from home in March 2020. According to the 7-page lawsuit her attorneys filed in federal court, Johnson, customer service representative since 2019, never received any negative performance evaluations. But after repeatedly complaining of problems with her hardware, specifically the headset used to take calls from clients, the company's feedback changed. The lawsuit describes headset glitches causing work calls to fade in and out, preventing Johnson from communicating with clients. When she complained, she was told to reboot her computer system, but the problem persisted. By May of 2020, even as COVID cases continued to mount, Concentrix told employees having trouble with their headsets, Johnson included, to return to the worksite. But Johnson, who suffers from a chronic pain condition, didn't feel safe returning to the office, according to the lawsuit. She provided a doctor's note, she claimed. Her manager asked her why she was missing calls. Johnson again pointed to the headset as the culprit. The next day, she claims she was terminated unexpectedly via phone call. Concentrix declined to comment on the case, citing confidentiality agreements with clients, staff, and former staff. Johnson, through attorney Alexander Kelly of the Kirby G. Smith Law Firm, is asking for a jury trial. Kelly didn't immediately return a request to comment on the case. And next we turn to the retail and restaurants page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of loans comes the article of local hotels miss payments. Despite the move toward a recovery in the travel and hospitality industries, commercial mortgage-backed securities portfolios with hotel properties in the Triangle have fallen deeper into financial distress. 8 local hotels were listed as being at least 60 days delinquent on mortgage payments, according to the latest watch list for CMBS portfolios, including some more than 12 months behind on payments. Each loan has been sent to special servicing due to imminent monetary default. The CMBS delinquency rate in the lodging industry continues to decrease since peaking last June at 24.3%, according to commercial mortgage data tracker TREP. The delinquency rate was 15.65% in April, reflecting a 10-month downward trend. In the Triangle, Hilton Garden Inn, Raleigh-Durham Airport in Morrisville, Homewood Suites in Cary, and Aloft Chapel Hill are part of Colony Capital's portfolio that is 13 months delinquent. The loan is for 48 hotels in 21 states and was originated for the same amount in 2017. The borrower has agreed to an orderly transition of the properties to a receiver since agreeable terms for a loan modification could not be reached, financial statements say. Lender has received several unsolicited offers for the assumption of modified debt and is assessing this as an option, as well as looking at all other options available for this portfolio. Hilton Garden Inn Raleigh-Durham Airport at 1500 RDU Center Drive in Marshall is the largest of the 3 local properties in the portfolio with 155 rooms and is appraised at $30.7 million. Homewood Suites at 100 McAllison Court in Cary is valued at $27 million and has 150 rooms. The 130-room Aloft Chapel Hill at 1001 South Hamilton Road has an $18.3 million value. Hilton Homewood Suites in Raleigh and Hilton Hampton Inn in Cary are part of the Schaedler NSSP hospitality portfolio, which also has not made a loan payment since March of 2020. The portfolio includes 21 properties in 9 states. The $204 million loan was originated in 2017 and currently has a balance for the same amount. Comfort Suites and Wingate Inn, both on Page Road in Durham, and Hyatt Place on Navajo Drive in Raleigh, also made the watch list. Also under heading of retail, mortgage lender launches Durham office. A retail mortgage lender has opened a new office in Durham as increased demand in the housing market spurs the firm's growth. Atlanta-based Angel Oak Home Loans recently opened its location at Sutton Station on Fayetteville Road. The office is managed by Audra Ange, who has industry experience in the Triangle. The full-service firm caters to first-time homebuyers and self-employed borrowers and now has 40 offices in 35 states. Angel Oak continues to expand across the country, but much of the firm's growth has been in the Southeast, says Senior Vice President and Divisional Manager Trit Reed. In Durham, home prices were up 10.6% in April compared to the previous year, Reed said, and homes are selling 10 days faster. The median home price is $315,000, he adds. Angel Oak already has an office in Raleigh. It's led by area manager Rick Dale. He oversees the company's Triangle market, which has grown 250% in the last 3 years. Durham is a spinoff of what we have been doing in the Triangle, Reed says. About 25% of the company's loan volume is from self-employed borrowers who use the non-qualified mortgage bank statement program, he says. And under the heading of restaurants, we have two short articles here in Durham, the Raleigh Brewery to join HIP development. A Raleigh-based brewery plans to expand to a huge mixed-use development in Durham later this year. Gizmo Brew Works will open its retail brewery this fall at University Hill off US 15501. The company started its original location on Triangle Drive in Raleigh in 2013 before launching its production site on East Franklin Street in Chapel Hill in 2019. The Durham brewery will be about 2,000 square feet with a large outdoor patio that overlooks a lower level beer garden and is surrounded by murals. The brewery will join the 300,000-square-foot development, which features restaurants, apartments, a gym, offices, and retailers. Gizmo Brew Works releases more than 100 beers per year and typically has about 30 on tap at a time. And finally, on the retail and restaurant page under the article under the heading He Said It, comes from Andrew Ullum, who is the owner of Union Special Bread, on avoiding the industry-wide labor shortage. The business started as an employee-first model where if you need time off, we give you the time off. The reason that we keep people around is because we're nice to them. Well, now we'll turn another page in this week's Triangle Business Journal and we find the real estate page. And the biggest article here is entitled North Hills, Advance Auto Looks to Sublease. 2 years ago, Advance Auto Parts made a splash in the Triangle office market when the Fortune 500 company announced plans for a new headquarters in North Hills. The huge retailer said it would lease 7 floors in what would become Advance Auto Parts Tower. But now the company's put multiple floors on the market for sublease. The Raleigh-based company has put floors 16, 17, and 18 on the market for a combined 93,573 square foot across the 3 floors. Advance Auto Parts currently leases space on the 12th floor and all of floors 16 through 21. The 20-story building sits along Six Forks Road and towers over the Beltline. Altogether, Advance Auto Parts Tower has 328,600 square feet of office space. It's unclear what led to Advance Auto Parts' decision to market the space, and the company did not return requests for comment. But last year, CEO Tom Greco said the company was reevaluating how it would use the space, given the shift to remote work brought on by the pandemic. We're going to move back into the office in a way that's safe for our people, and that may mean not everybody's there 5 days a week, Greco said at the time. We're looking at which roles can be effectively done remotely. Marketing materials from JLL list Advance Auto Parts lease term through the end of 2032. Each floor totals around 31,000 square feet of space and includes cafe and kitchen spaces and conference center. Kane Realty Corporation finished construction on the tower late last year, and the floors have never been occupied. The decision to sublease the space comes as the company looks to expand its retail footprint across the country following years of consolidation. On an earnings call in February, Greco says he expects the firm to open between 50 and 100 new stores this year. In 2020, the company saw $10.1 billion in sales, including $2.4 billion in the fourth quarter, up 12% from the same quarter in 2019. And a couple of small articles here. First from Carey, developer maps 160 new homes. A national home builder with a growing footprint in the Triangle is looking to bring a new community to Cary near a shopping center. In May, California-based TriPoint Homes filed a rezoning request for McCrone Parkway, a proposed 160-home residential development on the northwest side of Cary. The project is situated on 31.8 acres at 4945, 5001, and 5025 Lewis Stevens Drive, down the road from the Harris Teeter anchored McCrimmon Corners Shopping Center at the corner with Davis Drive. The site is also located less than 2 miles from the Cary Wegmans off Davis Drive at Airport Boulevard. And under the rezoning heading, Florida developer plans Apex project. A Florida-based developer is joining the rush to Apex with plans for a new mixed-use development. Earlier this year, LG Investments of Coral Springs filed a rezoning request with the town of Apex for the Holland Road mixed-use assembly, calling for 110 new homes and more than 60,000 square feet of commercial space, plus an additional outparcel. The project is situated on 28.7 acres, across seven parcels at the corner of Holland Road and Old US 1, across the street from Vicious Fish's Brewery and Piranha Joe Coffee. The land is owned by a collection of families and companies in Apex. Filings with the city call for 100 townhomes and 10 single-family detached homes for the residential portions. Plans split the assemblage into four parts, separated by use. From north to south, these include single-family detached homes, townhomes, commercial and office, and retail and outparcel. Well, now we turn the page to this week's healthcare page, and we find under the heading of Seeking FDA Nod, the article Durham Firm's Tech Detects Lingering Damage in Lungs. A Durham company's imaging technology for lungs has illustrated the ability to detect long-haul COVID-19 in a recent study by Oxford University. The study, published in the journal Radiology on May 25th, used Polarian Imaging's drug-device combination to illustrate lung damage in 9 patients who had mild COVID-19 months after they were discharged from the hospital. Difficulty breathing is among the most common persistent symptoms in people who have had COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The hyperpolarized xenon MRI detected that the patients had difficulty transferring gas from their lungs to their blood cells when other tests, such as CT scans, showed lung function in the normal range. While the study was small, the paper states the technology appears to provide an explanation for patient symptoms not explained by other clinical data or imaging techniques. It does not pose a radiation burden to the patient and be completed in a single breath hold. Polarian CEO Richard Hullin says more studies demonstrating the drug-device combination's ability to capture abnormal lung function are already out there, and more are on the way. A decision from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is expected this fall, he says. Polarian went public on the London Stock Exchange in March of 2018 to raise money for its clinical trials. Hullin says he expects his team of 12 to grow to about twice its current size by this time next year, with 90% of the capital it raises going toward commercialization and launch. FDA approval of the technology could revolutionize pulmonology by allowing doctors to capture images of lung function following treatment for lung cancer, as well as catching other early-stage lung diseases, Hullin says. If you're an infant and your parents already know that you're likely going to having cystic fibrosis, managing the leading edge of that and their therapeutic regime over their lifespan is critical to getting these kids to adulthood and beyond, which can be done if you have the right tools, he says. Well, on the next page, we reach our cover story for this week's Triangle Business Journal, and that cover story is entitled The Triangle's Great Graying. Bob Hatley has traveled all over the country and overseas, but when it came time to retire, he knew there wasn't any place he wanted to be more than his home state of North Carolina. Whether there are fantastic places to visit, none of them we want to live in, the retired banker says. We want to live in North Carolina. The state has everything anyone could want in their retirement, Hatley says, like having four seasons, relatively affordable housing, excellent hospital systems, a slower pace of living, and congenial people. You could also be at the beach or in the mountains inside of 3 hours from any of the state's big cities, offering a variety of options for vacations to get away from it all, he says. Retirees and people close to it have taken notice and have been flocking to the state in large numbers, helping grow the state's population by almost 1 million in the past decade. As a result, North Carolina now ranks 9th in the country for the number of people it has over the age of 65. That group grew by 41.9% between 2010 and 2019, compared to 34.2% in the U.S. as a whole. Market trends analysis are certain the graying of the state is expected to incubate a new line of businesses that would cater to the elderly in the coming years. That in turn may bring noticeable change to the area's supply of real estate, business services, and various available amenities. Essentially, local municipalities may soon have to make adjustments to how they allocate taxpayers' dollars to improve the quality of life for its citizens. We have population aging coming from two factors, says Rebecca Tippett, founding director of Carolina Demography at the UNC Chapel Hill's Carolina Population Center. One is baby boomers beginning to turn 65 in 2011, and we just kind of have people having birthdays. But the other is that North Carolina really emerged about 20 years ago as a retiree destination. That growth is expected to continue. The 65 and older group is expected to grow by another 56% in the next two decades, according to state populations. The trend is not unexpected, says Heather Burkhart, executive director of the North Carolina Coalition on Aging. When you read books about the age wave and the silver tsunami, these are certainly things we expected, but it's here now. New York and Florida are the largest contributors to the retiree migration into North Carolina, followed by neighboring states, Virginia, Georgia, and South Carolina, Tippett says. Some of those migrants are halfbacks who originally moved to Florida from New York and then move halfway back up the coast to North Carolina. There's some folks who come to North Carolina because they've been vacationing here during their work life, and so when they retire, they want to move to North Carolina, Burkhart says. Some people move from Florida because, as Hatley said, they prefer the changing of the seasons to warm weather year-round. A lot of people like a change of season, Hatley says. Something about celebrating Christmas in 90-degree weather. It's just not very appealing to a lot of people. The most attractive places for retirees to settle have been along the coast and beach communities in Brunswick and Dare counties, which saw a respective increase of 102% and 59% in their retiree population in the past decade. Urban areas, such as counties in the Triangle and Mecklenburg County, also saw their retiree population grow almost twice as much as the rest of the county. For example, Wake County saw its retiree population grow by 75%. Durham and Orange counties saw an increase of 68%, and Mecklenburg saw an increase of 57%. Migration to these areas could be because they have a strong economy, good health care system, and a lower cost of living that attracts young workers, Burkhart says. Those workers' parents and grandparents follow close behind to stay close to the family. Those areas also have terrific universities, and many older adults like to be around a community of mixed ages that includes young people, Hetley says. If they want to retire in a retirement community, there's plenty of really excellent choices that are still really close to hospitals and shopping and all that, Hetley says. Just like every other demographic group, older adults are not a monolith, and some people are better prepared for retirement than others. AARP, a nonprofit focused on issues affecting the 50 and older population, prepared a snapshot of older adult spending with the Economist Intelligence Unit, which is the financial publication's research and analysis arm. According to that data, older adults account for 36% of the population, contribute $225 billion, or 40%, to the state's GDP, and $16 billion in tax revenue, which is 38% of the state's total. In 2018, 56 cents of every dollar spent in the state was spent by older adults, and that's expected to grow to 61 cents by 2050. By 2030, that spending is expected to support 2.8 million jobs statewide. Beyond the necessities of life, what older adults spend money on varies from person to person, Burkhart says. Common threads, however, seem to be traveling, going to the symphony and arts activities, spending on children and grandchildren, and investing in continuing education, among other things. For those who saved and have assets, they want to enjoy life and do the things and hobbies they always wanted to do, Burkhart says. Hatley says he spends much of his time traveling between his home in Boone, where he went to school at Appalachian State University, and Ocean Isle. Besides lots of traveling in general, he says, he also plays a lot of golf. Michael Olander, state director of AARP North Carolina, says that as people are living longer, they're choosing to work longer. By 2030, the 50-plus population is expected to number 1.7 million and make up 33% of the state's workforce. The ability for older adults to work as long as they want to without having to worry about age discrimination should be supported, he says. They already make up most of the state's entrepreneurs and still have a lot of value to add, Olander says. Many people feel like they're just getting started their lives when they get into their 50s because they're able to use their skill sets and their interests and leverage them in ways they couldn't when they were younger, Olander says. While he's no longer working, Hatley stays plugged into the community and contributes through serving on the boards for different nonprofits and organizations. Older adults in the state also contribute value through their unpaid contributions. An average of 52 hours of volunteering and 460 hours of caregiving that are valued at $3.6 billion and $18.7 billion, respectively. While older adults contribute enormous value to the state and country, Richard Johnson, senior fellow and director of the Program on Retirement Policy at the think tank Urban Institute, says having an aging population in conjunction with low birth rates is a demographic ticking time bomb. For the first time in 2019, the number of people over 60 in the state outnumbered those under 17. And more than half of the counties in the state experienced natural declines, meaning more people died than were born. Within 20 years, 95 of the state's 100 counties will have populations where older adults outnumber minors. If most of your population growth is coming from older people and not from working age people, then that means your tax base is going to shrivel, Johnson says. You're going to have to provide more services to this growing older population, so that can create real pressures. There are a large number of people who find themselves unprepared for retirement for a variety of reasons, such as lower lifetime earnings, or they develop financial hardships during retirement because of things like the death of a spouse, natural disasters, or financial exploitation. What's a challenge for communities is that old people use a lot of health care, Johnson says. Particularly if you're thinking about people who become disabled, who become frail, who need help with basic everyday activities, that can create a strain on communities. There's a shortage of home care workers nationally because there aren't enough people willing to do these jobs, Johnson says, in part because of poor pay. There are about 191 companies in the state that provide those services. On average, the state's home health care workers were paid $11.02 per hour, or $22,920 a year, in 2020, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. At the same time, home health care has a median cost of $4,004 per month, according to the insurance company Genworth's Cost of Care Survey. A lot of older people have trouble affording those services, so people go into Medicaid, which can pay for those home services. But there's a waiting list for Medicaid, and that can create a problem and a strain on state and county governments. In the 2019-20 fiscal year, the state spent $89.4 million on those costs for just under 94,000 individuals. A lot of time, unfortunately, caregivers are family members, and typically are unpaid family members, says Tara Myers, the State Department of Health and Human Services, Secretary for Employment, Inclusion, and Economic Stability. And to add to that, not only are they unpaid family members, but are likely trying to hold down a job to support themselves and their family. In 2018 in North Carolina, about 473,600 caregivers provided about 538 million hours worth of compensated care valued at $6.8 billion. That may become too much for some families who often have no training to take on. Others may not have families to turn to for support, which could lead to institutionalization. Roughly 3% of the state's older adults end up in one of the state's 423 nursing homes, or roughly 1,200 assisted living facilities. Genworth puts the median cost for a nursing home in the state at $8,060 a month for a private room and $3,800 a month for assisted living facilities. In the 2019-20 fiscal year, the state spent $1.45 million in Medicaid costs for roughly 52,000 people in nursing homes. But more than 80% of older adults in the state are homeowners, and Meyer says the goal is to prevent as much as we can from individuals going into an institutional setting. Myers adds that's why the state is trying to funnel even more funds into the home and community-based services. If we could get Medicaid expansion, we would definitely be in a much better position to provide and expand services, Myers says. North Carolina is one of about a dozen states that hasn't enacted Medicare expansion, which has been a continuous issue in the state legislature for several years. The government at both the state and federal levels is well aware of the need to address the challenges that come with a rapidly aging population. The American Rescue Plan Act includes a provision that increases the reimbursement rate for home and community-based services by 10 percentage points between April of 2021 and March 31st of 2022, potentially increasing spending by $11.4 billion nationally. Advocates say helping older adults stay in the workforce and remain independent for as long as possible is key, though Johnson says that doesn't address the declining birth rates. It will only exacerbate the situation 20 years down the line. That creates real economic pressure, because you have a declining number of workers supporting a growing number of retirees, Johnson says. That means additional infrastructure needs to be put in place to make child care more affordable, so people are more inclined to have kids, he says. That's definitely a long-term solution to this, Johnson says, because someone has a child today and they're not going to start paying taxes for at least 22 years, probably. Encouraging immigration would also alleviate these pressures, he says. This isn't a phenomenon that's exclusive to the state of North Carolina or even the U.S., but is happening across the globe in places like Japan, China, Italy, and France, among others, Johnson says. China has a huge demographic imbalance there because of the one-child policy, Johnson says. You have a growing older population and a stagnating or shrinking younger population. It really creates a demographic time bomb. Next, we turn to the executive voice page for this week's Triangle Business Journal. And this week's executive voice belongs to Jim Weaver. Jim Weaver's the state's chief information officer, and his agenda is broad and ambitious. And if you're a frequent listener, you know this is always a Q&A format. So here's a little bit, and the journal has questions, and Jim Weaver will provide his answers. Armed with extensive experience in the public sector, Jim Weaver, the newly minted chief information officer for the state of North Carolina, says he's ready to hit the ground running. And North Carolina is set up for continued success in the technology space, Weaver says. During his tenures in Pennsylvania and the state of Washington, he says he often looked at North Carolina as a model, especially with its holistic approach to cybersecurity. Weaver now leads the NC Department of Information Technology, which oversees and provides IT services to state agencies, local governments, and educational institutions across North Carolina. So, tell us about the Office of the NCCIO. The department was established as a cabinet-level agency in 2015 to consolidate enterprise IT functions within the executive branch. With more than 1,100 employees, the NCDIT is responsible for the Government Data Analytics Center, the 911 Board, the NC Health Information Exchange, and the Broadband Infrastructure Office. So, what do you plan to accomplish in your first 100 days? When taking this job, I knew I was going to have to hit the ground running and that the state's top three priorities are broadband, cybersecurity, and digital transformation. Since my arrival, I've spent time listening to the people at NCDIT, to leaders in other agencies, to elected officials, and to our vendor partners. It's made me even more excited about the work ahead. The team here in North Carolina is doing amazing things. Now that I've spent some time hearing the challenges and accomplishments, I can begin to develop a plan. I'll be doing that over the next month or so with the help of my senior leaders and intend to have a plan in place by mid-summer. So how's your background prepared you for this role? I've been very fortunate to work as a C-level executive in two states prior to being provided the opportunity to serve in Governor Roy Cooper's administration. Additionally, I spent a significant portion of my public sector career providing technology services within the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services and have never lost the focus that technology supports and enables the agency business objectives. It does not drive or dictate them. What's your assessment of the state of technology in North Carolina? From a state government aspect, North Carolina is viewed as a top 10 state. During my tenures in Pennsylvania and Washington, I often looked at North Carolina as a model for what we could achieve, especially when we look at the fantastic work that's been done in a state holistic approach to cybersecurity. We are so fortunate to have a robust joint cyber task force staffed daily by the many talented individuals within our National Guard. But with that said, we have work to do. We've all seen the impact of not having high-speed internet connectivity and further the digital divide this has created. Governor Cooper made it very clear that this is my top priority, followed by continued enhancement of the state's cyber programs And finally, enhancing and delivering effective IT solutions that enable our state agencies to achieve the outcomes and needed services that many North Carolinians depend upon daily. What are your big goals in terms of the state's technology capabilities? First, become a top five state for the delivery of high-speed internet connectivity. So raise high-speed internet subscriptions from 73 to 80%. Increase adoption rates to 80% across all racial subgroups and raise the percentage of households with children with high-speed internet access from 81 to 100%. Second, transform services from an online mode to a true digital government mode. And third, emphasize the North Carolinian as to what and how they need to engage with digital services. This is not a technology issue, but a need to refocus on the people and process part of the equation. So what tech trends do you find most appealing? I'm fascinated by how much AI and RPA is robotic process automation, could benefit government operations and service delivery. The Internet of Things continues to develop at a rapid rate, and I've seen some very amazing use cases in support of the pandemic battle. So what's the best advice you've ever received? Make your bed every morning. This is a simple task, but one that instills discipline and pride and sets your day on a positive note. While my parents may have tried earlier in my childhood, this remains a point of emphasis by my lovely wife. So finally, what's been your greatest challenge? In Washington, I took over an agency that was in deficit spending, had morale issues, and a customer service rating of 1 on a scale of 1 to 5. As I was preparing to depart Washington, Governor Jay Inslee presented me with a picture of the Washington State Capitol being built and commented that when he looked at this picture, it reminded him of the rebuilding and repairing that I was able to do. It's a cherished memory and a gift I hold very dear. Next, we get to Jim Verdonick's small business article entitled Finding the Right Model, Key to Driving Revenue. Experienced entrepreneurs know their revenue model is a key to survival, growth, and training, and raising capital from investors. That's one big reason investors like experienced management teams. My partner and I run a free legal clinic for startup companies, supervising Campbell Law School students who provide free services. Most of the businesses the clinic serves are pre-revenue. Most of the entrepreneurs have never started a business before. Our students are often surprised that many entrepreneurs can't describe their revenue model. Many focus on how great their product will be after they finish developing it, but they often can't answer questions about how they intend to generate revenue from their great product. Or they'll use a buzzword like SaaS, but not be able to describe how they will implement it. One of my jobs as a lawyer is to help businesses identify and implement their revenue model. This involves several different functions. One, describing revenue model to investors in pitch decks and securities offering disclosure statements. Two, preparing contracts suitable for each revenue model. And three, intellectual property projections suitable for each model. So here's just a revenue model, and I'll just read the headings for the names of the models in the sake of time. So there's brick and mortar, where customers pay for products. There's bricks and clicks, so products can be purchased or returned online or to a physical location. Affiliate programs or pay action. Advertising supported. Subscription. Pay-per-view or use. Marketplace platform. Transaction processing fees, reselling user information, freemium, intellectual property licensing like patents, trademarks, and copyrights, franchising, and in-app purchases or subscriptions. With so many revenue model choices, many businesses may change revenue models or add additional revenue models over time. They start out thinking they know the future revenue model, then they find out it was wishful thinking. Quickly recognizing when your marketplace isn't accepting your revenue model, the reasons why, and launching new revenue models is a key survival tool. If you add or change revenue models, update your lawyers before they provide advice or create documents. Well, now we've reached the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and here's the editor's notebook entitled, New Building Regs Needed to Protect Workers. The idea to write this column came from the National Hockey League. Just hours after Governor Roy Cooper announced relaxed COVID rules for everyone, we thought the upcoming NHL playoff series between the Carolina Hurricanes and the Nashville Predators would have a full house in attendance. After all, Cooper is a big Canes hockey fan. We thought wrong. The NHL had other ideas. The league reiterated to all the teams that unless the areas are equipped with a more sophisticated HVAC system, fans still need to be distanced from each other. Within days, a new air conditioning system was installed at PNC Arena that allows for a recalibration of outside airflow requirements, essentially meaning the building was drawing more air from outside at quicker intervals. The math is simple, really. If the building is 10% full, everyone in that building is getting 10 times the ventilation air, according to the American Society of Heating, Refrigerating, and Air Conditioning Engineers, the standard-setting body for homes, restaurants, and office buildings. So all this talk about sports arenas made me think about a slightly more important matter. If arena air systems are being reinforced to make it safer to watch live sports for 3 hours, what are we doing with the office buildings where workers are there in excess of 8 hours? The answer so far, not much. Currently, a new commercial building's certificate of occupancy is not tied to the health of the building. Rather, it's tied to the physical safety. While HVAC systems are renewed, building health does not play a role in green lighting a building to open up. In fact, we currently have minimal rules regarding airflow in commercial buildings. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention already has come out with recommendations suggesting building owners should be running ventilation systems with maximum outside airflow for 2 hours before and after occupied times and boosting the percentage of outdoor air the system uses. Sounds easy, right? Not really. The change will be expensive. Introducing UVC technology to a building's current system and adding things such as high-efficiency particulate air filters has a big price tag. Who's going to pay for that? Here's the easy part. Before signing any lease renewals, employers should demand these office buildings owners upgrade their air filtration system before allowing workers to go back to work. Nothing will matter if an office building circulates sick air. And companies that own their own buildings, well, they should upgrade their systems as well. It may be time for new air regulations in commercial buildings that will need annual reviews from the health departments of every state. As much as we hate new regulations, if you want people to sit and work under one roof every day for 8 hours or more, you will need a better air filtration system. And we have not even touched the subject of potential legal liability for companies and building owners. The U.S. has billions of square feet of office buildings that may be more than 20 to 30 years old and house millions of workers across the nation. We may be on the back end in dealing with COVID-19, but what about the next virus? How do we protect our workers then? The safety of commercial buildings is extremely important to monitor, but now the health of these buildings should be, too. Now we get to the guest editorial for this week's Viewpoint page, and that editorial is written by Alexandra Sirota. Sirota is director at the North Carolina Justice Center. Instead of focusing on labor shortage and misinformation and policies around work search requirements and one-time incentives to get people back to work, state lawmakers should devote their energy to upgrading North Carolina's stingy unemployment insurance, or UI, system. More than 1 year after the pandemic drove unprecedented job loss, data show that UI plays a critical role in the labor market, stabilizing households and communities, and advancing equity by race and geography for employment outcomes in North Carolina. North Carolina leaders have to decide, do they want our state to be a place where people reach their full potential and make the greatest contributions to their community and economy? Or they want people to work for the lowest wages? Unemployment insurance with higher wage replacement and a standard duration of 26 weeks is more likely to lead to better job matches that ensure jobless workers don't fall behind prior earnings and employers have the stable, strong workforce they need. Several unemployment trends evident from the past year require a response from policymakers at the state level. Federal UI was critical to stabilizing income in the past year. Without it, many households would have faced even greater hardship. Federal UI has kept the economic devastation of the COVID-19 pandemic in check, but North Carolina will be vulnerable if our state benefits remain inadequate, especially in the absence of federal assistance. North Carolina was one of eight states where income from federal UI represented 80% of the total UI income received in the past year. These states have systems that offer fewer weeks of state UI than the national standard of 26 weeks, provide lower wage replacement, and have higher monetary eligibility requirements. North Carolina provides 12 weeks of UI. Jobs are not fully recovered, and too many North Carolinians who face barriers like low access to child care can't rejoin the labor market. Public health risks attached to returning to work remain, and many working families struggle to find child care, transportation, and stable housing. Refusing to address much-needed changes to our state system or accepting federal unemployment assistance will create further hardships for far too many North Carolinians. North Carolina's UI system continues to fall short in ensuring that job loss doesn't further grow hardship or destabilize economic well-being. State policymakers' failure to provide adequate wage replacement and equitable access to UI generates greater uncertainty for the trajectory of the recovery overall, contributes to inequities in the current recovery, and is likely to generate a host of negative outcomes for health and well-being in the long run. UI plays a critical role for communities that experienced higher economic distress before COVID-19 and for people of color who face greater barriers to employment. Black workers represent a greater share of the overall labor force in North Carolina, as in other states that heavily rely on federal maintenance of their labor market through UI. The current outcomes are, in part, traceable to the power wielded by white landowners who dictated the early federal state design of UI so that state policy choices could further exclude black workers. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. If you have comments or questions, call us, 919-832-5138. So long till next time.